Ian, okay, it says it's recording, please.
Okay, I'm John McCartney, McCartney, capital M-A-R-T, M-A-C-A-R-T-N-E-Y. That was off to a good start, can't even spell my own name, but McCartney is M-A-C-A-R-T-N-E-Y. I was born on the 24th of July 1945 at Mackay, Queensland. My parents, they come from sort of military backgrounds. I had half-brothers that served in the Defence Force. So it was one of the things that I sort of progressed into. Mm-hmm. I joined the Navy in 1961, July 6th of July 1961, as a junior recruit at the age of 15, and spent my first 12 months over at a place called HMAS Lewin, a junior recruit training establishment over in Western Australia. We learnt basic seamanship, sailing and what have you, but primarily it was academic studies, which took us to around about Victorian Leaving Standard. And from there, I elected to go into the electrical branch, and I did a ship's electrical course, then moved to a ship's radio course, so I qualified as a ship's radio tech. And when the others went off to sea to the various vessels, I changed over to aircraft and spent another 6 months in a classroom doing air conversion. Initially, had to qualify to sign on two types of aircraft, a Wessex anti-submarine helicopter and a Sea Venom, a de Havilland Sea Venom fighter, jet fighter, carrier borne type one. From that, I moved on to light helos and spent 2 years at sea on Gannets, an anti-submarine aircraft, twin engine, double mamba engine, counter-rotating props at the front, primarily a submarine hunter, once again carrier borne. And then from that, I spent the rest of my life mainly on 723 Squadron on Hueys. Except for the last 2 years, I spent on radio-controlled target systems, both seaborne and airborne. My time in Vietnam started when my wife was probably about 3 months pregnant.
With your first child?
With our first child, yep. Yeah. We spent about 6 months training to go. They took our naval uniforms away, gave us jungle greens to make us look like soldiers. So we had to slow the speech down to be like real soldiers. From that we learnt weapon handling, which is, you know, sort of taken to the next step. We'd all qualified with small arms prior but at some stage, but this was sort of to the next level. Learned a lot about the sort of the country, the culture and things like that. My daughter, eldest child, was 3 days old, and I went off to play in the army for 12 months in Vietnam. At one end of the flight, I was a petty officer, Royal Australian Navy. At the other end of the flight, I was a Sergeant E7 NCOIC of the 68 Signal Detachment, attached to the 135th AHC, providing avionics and communication support. It was an interesting sort of environment to go into because the avionics systems were totally different to ours, so had to learn new equipment, new operating procedures, new maintenance procedures, new administrative procedures, also things like ground communications. Although I was a ship's radio tech originally, I still didn't really know a great deal about ground communications and things like telephones, the thing on the wall that used to ring. But I suddenly found I had to look after them as well. And you actually have to climb poles, and I'd never heard of climbing spikes to strap onto your feet and run up. And a guy called Bill Murphy, he said, trust me, you climb the pole, and if things go wrong, you just sort of lean backwards and your safety belt will save you. It does not work that way. When your foot slips, there is no way in the world you're going to throw yourself backwards and trust the belt. You wrap your arms around the pole and slide down and get 2,852 splinters in your crutch. But it's all a learning experience. The other things that we learned that there were some nasty people out in the bush that used to throw things over at us that went bang in the night. My first encounter with those at Black Horse, they There were Black Horse being our first base. That was a big learning experience. We arrived in Saigon and or Tonsonut, and we had to wait for a 123 to fly us up to Black Horse. And while we were waiting, we found a little cafe and went in there. It was run by some Vietnamese girls, and there was a whole bunch of US Air Force fellows in there. And there was this tremendous explosion, and the girls all screamed. The blokes ran, so everybody else was running, so we thought we may as well as well. So and went outside to find out what Vietnamese thunder sounded like. Most embarrassing, but it was a bit of a learning experience. And then we arrived at Black Horse. I'm not sure where the name Black Horse comes from, because it's all red mud in the wet season and red dust in the dry season. Beautiful fine red talcum powder that gets into everything. The sort of experience of going IF when you do a landing or takeoff with all this red cloud around you. My first sort of stores run was a bit frightening, because everybody piled into the helicopter to take broken parts and things down to Vung Tau to exchange. And there was no all-up weight calculations. It was sort of pull up on the stick, and the torque gauge went into the red, you and that box out. Give it another go, that box out, yep. And we shuddered forward and away we went, and good grief, we're all going to die. But actually, we made it. So that was an interesting experience. I was a mechanic, a radio mechanic. So my vision that was given to us, that we'd go to Vietnam, we'd sit there in air-conditioned comfort in a very well-equipped workshop, and we'd fix radios. That was the vision. Well, it was a bit different to that. A couple of the containers that we had used for workshops had air conditioners in them, and that was about it. I was probably there in my first week, and an American pilot came in and said, "Grab your gear, let's go." I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Oh, I need a door gunner." "I'm not a gunner." And that was my first experience as flying as a door gunner. We single ship, we took a guy up into the bush just on dark and dropped him into the bush. And to say that I was scared shitless is probably an understatement, but the sound of the rotor blades was probably drowned out by my knees knocking. But it was, enlightening. And then eventually, you know, I used to fly as a door gunner relatively regularly. Used to do a lot of test flights, which was something else that I'd never experienced before. Jerry Schoenberg, he was one of the maintenance test pilots. Used to fly with him a lot. And then I flew a CNC with somebody when I first got there to find out what an assault helicopter actually did. And that was a learning experience as well. Good ringside seat to action in relative safety. So CNC was a good thing to fly at. Altitude is always good. Our avionics section consisted of an American signal officer, a warrant officer. Chief warrant officer was the first guy, who was a dedicated radio tech from the Army and a career man. And the second guy was a pilot, Jimmy Sherderman, who was doing other duties as required and became the signal officer when Sanders left. And Jim was a great guy. We flew a lot together. And he was the boss. I was the NCOIC, and we had one other sailor, Frank Lord, and the rest of them were American, US guys. We ran short of people at one stage, and we got general cooks and bottle washers and trained them to be lines people. And that was a godsend to get some extra people in. You know, you worked long hours. Things didn't necessarily go to plan. You used to go pear-shaped, but you used to have to adapt and to make do. Our original base at Black Horse, we wore out our welcome there. And just before Christmas in 68, we moved over to Bearcat. And lost the luxury of our air-conditioned tents. Well, when the flaps are up, they're air-conditioned. And we'd moved into wooden buildings for accommodation. I think 9th Division was there. They moved down to Dong Tam and we moved in after them. We sent an advance party over to clean the area up, and one of the fellows, a sailor by the name of Noel Shipp, who was later killed, he had the sort of the ability to always upset people. And the company next to us, the Greyhounds, the 240th, they had this big radio tower with a Greyhound on it. And one night, Noel climbed up there and painted big red rats, so kangaroos, red kangaroos all over there, magnificent Greyhound. And to add insult to injury, he greased the pegs and the ladder on the way down. So when we arrived, there was open hostilities. They hated our guts, and we never ever really got along very well with the Greyhounds. They were an odd bunch of people. We had a sister company there, the 335th Cowboys. They were all lunatics. They actually say the same thing about us, but they're being unkind, whereas I'm not. I'm real. Yes, they were a different bunch of blokes. Great people. They like to get a bit excited when had after a couple of cans of beer. And with the 240th, the Greyhounds, they little things like they used to walk past my workshop on their way to their maintenance area, and they threw some rubbish on the ground. And so I went out and said, "Would you mind not doing that? But don't be a grub. You know, leave your rubbish around here." So they collected a bunch of garbage bins and emptied them all around the workshop. And a friend of a friend was in artillery, and so I got all this concertina bloody wire, the razor wire, and put it all around the workshop. So they couldn't do a shortcut through there. They had to do a big walk around the area. And at night they'd come in with a jeep and or a three-quarter ton and tow the barbed wire away. And next day I'd get some more and put out there. And it was a little game we played. And until, unfortunately, I didn't have a sense of humour one morning and found it gone, so I went down and saw their top sergeant and sort of got on my tippy toes and reached up and poked him in the chest and said, if it happens again, I'm going to have you charged with willful destruction of US government property. And it stopped, and that little game was a bit disappointing because it was something we used to enjoy. It was a little bit of a tassel here and there. And I had a visiting some Australian soldiers from, they were SIGs, and they were doing some experiment, and I hosted them. And one of them went over to the Greyhounds area and was having a shower, and the top sergeant came in and found this foreigner in his showers, and he abused him. And anyway, this bloke sort of replied with sort of, "Get a life, and if you're over in Nui Dat, use as much water as you like, now piss off and grow up and leave me alone." And so I had to front their CO the next morning to apologise profusely for the action of my men. And, had sort of little things like that, but they used to sort of niggle us a fair bit. Although they had a change of CO just before we left, and he hosted a farewell party for us. And so the 135th, the 335th and the Greyhounds could all get together and be one big happy family occupying Black Horse. So I don't know if that continued, but there was a lot of aggro during our time there. That it was one of those little things that used to keep you on your toes.
Yeah. Are you ready to take a break or?
Oh, no.
No. I have questions.
Yeah,
I didn't want to stop you.
Yep, no.
Okay, so you described some interesting things with the other units. The funniest thing that ever happened in Vietnam that you could remember.
Oh, there were several. There's things like one of the maintenance sergeants is an E6 or an E7, Howard Arms. Howdy had his foot in the wrong place and found that the weight of the skids of a H model actually tends to crush the bones in your foot when it lands on it.
Oh.
And so he had a broken foot and he had a cast on it and he was on Stilson. Howdy was a fairly rotund fellow. Either that or he was about 8.5 months pregnant, so I think he was probably rotund. And I used to show movies in a big open area. And we were out there one night doing that, and some stuff fell out of the sky, and you know, the stand to alarm and all that sort of stuff went, and had the silhouette of him with a wearing underpants, a flak vest, a helmet, and on crutches with his foot sticking out like that, doing about 90 miles an hour going towards the bunker. And you know, if you mention his name, that's one of the things that immediately flashes into my mind. But, it was quite amusing. So, no doubt, not to him, but it was to me. But yeah, you know, odd little things like that was probably the most amusing.
That's cute. Coming back to your training, so I understand the first little bit was basically just to like get you out of our equivalent of high school and in essence have a decent education.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a washout in that and then the other trainings?
There was from our junior recruit school. I saw some stats the other day. There was something like 96% of us graduated.
Ah.
Of the 155, I think, that went there, there was 96% graduated on to go out into the fleet to train in various professions within the Navy.
Now, and they were 100% volunteers. You guys did not have a draft or anything like that.
In the Navy, we were, but we were all volunteers because we knew we'd volunteered when our name came out on the signal saying, you're off to Vietnam.
Oh, I see.
That was our volunteering.
Oh, okay, fine.
So, we were all permanent naval forces, and it was just a posting. We couldn't volunteer to do it.
Yeah, now when you signed up initially, what was your commitment?
12 years.
12?
12 years at the age of 15. It's quite a commitment.
And your parents were okay with that?
Yes. There was no major drama with that. I came from a rural community of farmers, so kids left school quite young and became farmers. There was a way of life in those days. So by disappearing off into the Navy was just another way of...
growing up.
Growing up, yeah.
Yeah.
And you did rather rapidly.
Yeah, interesting. No, I was shocked when I heard that 9 years and 12-year rigs. That was good.
And that's why when we went into the Army, the Army guys considered us to be lifers, whereas I found that insulting because I wasn't a lifer. I was a short-termer. I was only doing 12 years, and I was off. It's all sort of in the mind of the definition of lifer.
Yeah, it is. Now... how many years would you have had to serve to draw a pension from the Navy?
When I first joined the Navy, and in fact when I even left the Navy, it was 20 years from the age of 20. Because I joined at 15, I would have had to have done 20 years. But after I got out, it became just a straight 20 years.
Uh-huh.
So at the age of 35, I could have got a naval pension.
Uh-huh. I was just curious, because... that's basically the same kind of rig that we have in America, but I wanted to hear it from you. You went through, all of you guys that I've talked to, went through lots of training opportunities. They seem to be, in my opinion, about 6 months shots or whatever. Were you happy with that, or did you think it was deficient, or
if
looking back, you could have been God, you could have tweaked it some, or what?
The actual naval training on equipment was probably about right. It was, like as a radio tech, you need that service background. Depends on what you're going to do. If you're just changing black boxes and aircraft, as I said before, you know, you can cooks and bottle washers type people can be trained to take an ARC 51 out of there, get another one and stick in there. Mm. No major skills required. But to actually get that ARC 51 and start repairing components within the different modules, that requires a higher level. So yes, so that type of training is needed, and that's what we got. From my own experience, going to Vietnam for the avionics side, it was very, very deficient. Because it was totally different equipment. We had old English equipment in our B models, When we bought the B models, they ripped out all the avionics, US avionics, and put in this old stuff. And there was new equipment that I had to learn. We could have been trained a lot more in the administration side of it, because you've got a totally different aircraft administration side of things and reporting system, different logbooks to what we use. We don't use things like circle red X's and things like that, so new terminologies, new practices, and also a better understanding of a company structure, what actually is an assault helicopter company, because I went there fairly blind as to what we actually did.
Really?
Yeah, for example, not in my wildest dreams, I ever thought I'd be a door gunner. Mm-hmm. That wasn't written in the contract. And so it was a bit of a shock to the system.
Uh-huh.
And probably a bit more of the interpersonal relationships, because the US guys speak funny, they've got different cultures. And some of the terminologies are quite different. Had too many beers one night and say, gee, I was pissed last night. Oh, what upset you? There's little things like that. And you think, ooh, strange. And also how to react to various situations. Like, I'd never run across people who took drugs before, and I wound up as Sergeant of the Guard or some such similar thing as a 23-year-old on the perimeter at Black Horse. And there was people there that they were strange. I kid you not, their eyes were rolling and they were totally out of control. And I said, the guard officer there, really affected. And he said, oh, you'll get used to it. Oh, God. But that was the only time I ever did that. We had one guy in the company, Spanky Watkins, and he used to abuse substance of some description, and he used to come looking for me and put his arms around me and try and cuddle me, and I used to see him coming and I used to hide. It was very difficult to get away from him. He used to take a shine for me. Another funny sort of situation was we had just beside our accommodation, we had the slip trench with sandbags all over it, and that was our bunker when things went bump in the night. And somebody said they saw a cobra in there, not the aircraft type, but no. The big hissy type.
Yeah.
And so it was decided that a few of us would arm ourselves and throw a whole bunch of bloody smoke grenades into this place and flush out all the cobras. And got the smoke grenades, heaved them in, all there waiting for this great big snake to appear, and all that came out was Spanky, streaming smoke. He'd been in there to let him sleep off a bit of an OD, and that was quite funny.
Talk to me about food.
Food, arrived at Black Horse, and my first meal was ham steak. I absolutely love ham steak. My second meal was ham steak. My third meal was ham steak. My fourth meal was ham steak. Bloody hell, I became sick of a ham steak. Had a fellow came wandering in and said, Sarge, can I get some M79 rounds off you? Well, at that stage, I'd only just arrived in country and I wasn't particularly known as a sergeant at that stage, or I didn't think I was an odd title to call me. And then I thought, well, why would you come into an avionics workshop and ask for M79 rounds? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll get some from the armory for you. I said, thanks a lot. And I said, where are you from? And he said, oh, F Troop. That was my favorite TV show, F Troop. Yeah. And anyway, it turns out he was a cab guy and from a F Troop. And so I gave him the M79 rounds and he was happy in the way he went. And thought that was very odd, and
because we had all the ammunition you could shake a stick at.
Well, yeah, there's being new to it, being new to Vietnam, being new to the U.S. Army, it was, you know, that must have been the way you guys operated, and And I was still becoming accustomed to having weapons and ammunition sort of everywhere, which is totally foreign in the Navy. And anyway, this guy disappeared, and a week or so later, he turned up again and he said, "I'd like to invite you over to a barbecue." Barbecued ham steak, I suppose that's a little bit different. He said, no, we were out in the field and in APCs, and there was movement in the bush where we'd been shot up before, and so we challenged the movement, and there was no reply, so we shot it up with a 50 cal and went over and we'd shot a water buffalo. And one of the guys back in the world was a butcher, and we got real steak. So we were over there and had this real steak water buffalo barbecue. It was bloody lovely. So it was well worth the M79. But overall, I don't like crispy bacon. So that was it. Scrambled eggs, to me, you break a couple of eggs into a bowl, beat them up, put some milk and herbs in, and herbs for you blokes that can't pronounce a H. But herbs in and mix it up and then put it into a fry pan and turn it over, and it's quite nice. And you go to an army cook and how do you like your eggs? Scramble, thanks. Breaks them and attacks them with it, smashes them all over the place, and you get this mutilated looking thing. And you go, ew, that with crispy bacon. But you did have maple syrup to soften it, so that was the other godsend. Prior to flying, I could really eat breakfast because I used to be rather apprehensive, but we used to have to go there to draw our rations for the day anyway, so you'd struggle with that. It was, but apart from that, the food was okay. I never had any, there was cottage cheese was there and I could not stand it, but I love cottage cheese now, so whether it was different then and my tastes have changed, I don't really know. I remember upsetting the catering cooking officer when we got back. Like Jim Schulman and I got back late, and we went over and they had roast beef, and this guy was making a big deal of how he had taken over and he'd personally supervised the cooking of this thing, and he got there and he carved it for us, and it was a bit red, and I said to Jim, "Look at that, put a band-aid on it, give it a bit of mouth to mouth, and be back out grazing in the paddock." And this guy's face dropped. Oh, absolutely insulted. But that was the way I like roast beef. And so once again, mouth got me into trouble, foot and mouth disease. But it was fine. No major dramas.
I saw this picture at your house yesterday of four or five guys holding a funnel into this man's mouth. Tell me about that picture, because it's quite funny. I thought it was funny. Especially since now you've changed a little bit, but so talk about that.
About 2 years ago, I received an email from a bloke called John Custer, who said, "You may not remember me, but I was one of your blokes in Vietnam," and went on, and I replied, "Yes, I remember you," and he said, "I'll always remember you for the wonderful first farewell party you threw for me." And I couldn't really remember it. It went straight over my head. And I sort of said, "What for farewell party?" And he sent me a photo. And there was a group of us gathered around him, and I'd stuffed a funnel into his mouth, and we were all pouring alcohol into John's mouth. And it's ironic now, because I'm a men's health advocate, and I promote responsible drinking, and at least it was responsible. We didn't spill anything on the floor. It all went straight into his mouth. So I guess there was a certain amount of responsibility there. But we used to let our hair down every now and again. I used to also look after the beer supplies, of Australian beer coming into the company. And we had a big turnover of Australian beer and supplied the BOQ, the Sergeant's Mess, and the EMS Mess. And in fact, at one stage, we were looked at as a bunch of alcoholics because of there was only about 50 of us and we were going through a pallet of beer a week, and they forgot that we were integrated into the US Army. And and there was a new type of beer that had a Sydney Harbour Bridge on, I can't remember what it was, it was sent up, and a U-21 pilot I knew, a bloke called Pat Lewis, he over at Longthan North, he was married to an Australian girl, so I went over to give him a case of this beer, and he was out flying, so I left it on his bed. And next day, he came over, and he was well worse for wear. He came back from flying, and on an empty stomach, saw this case of beer lying there with her things of Sydney on it. So he started drinking it and put the rest in the fridge, and he consumed this case of beer, and he came over accusing me of trying to kill him. And he wasn't very healthy. Anyway, he brought a bottle of Jack Daniels over and gave to me in exchange. And that sort of sat in the workshop for ages. And Jim Sherman and I had been out flying, and we got back late. We'd missed the evening meal, and there was always Coke in the fridge. So we I remember this bottle of Jack Daniels, and so we got stuck into it with some Coke. And must have been around about midnight, the night crew got sick of the their officer and senior NCO flopping around the floor like untrained seals, so they threw us out into the night. So Pat got his revenge. Neither of us were very well the next morning.
So you guys really didn't work ever short on Australian beer?
No. We used to do a beer run down to Vung Tau or Saigon. Predominantly flew. I found that you could sit on the deck on a Huey with your feet on the skids and not fall out, because there wasn't enough room on the seats because it was full of beer. We used to do that. Originally, we had an arrangement with the Air Force where they used to bring beer in, but our boss stuffed that up, and that's saying it nicely, and so we had to go and get ourselves. And so I used to always fly to Vung Tau. I didn't like driving down there, but I used to drive down to Saigon, pick it up. Mm-hmm. And there's always aircraft available that you could use.
So what was your biggest challenge in Vietnam? I mean, you've described challenge with vernaculars, with new systems, with equipment, uniforms, the whole bit. Everything changed except the person. But what was your biggest challenge if you look back in those days?
Probably the interpersonal skills of adapting to a different culture. But that sort of you work with that and you overcome with time. Probably my biggest challenge was trying to come to grips with mortars and rockets. I never really achieved that. They used to really frighten me. I was grovelling in the dirt one day where some rockets fell, and there's a pair of boots appeared in front of me, and I sort of looked at them and looked up, and there was a Thai NCO there. And he's looking down at me, and he said, "Do the rockets frighten you?" And sort of standard response of, "Yes, they rather do, you old chap," or words to that effect. And anyway, he gave me a clay Buddha, and he said, "Buddha will protect you from rockets." And so I got Buddha, and I put him in my wallet, and it worked. I was never killed by rockets. When I came back to Australia, I shook the dust of poor old Buddha out, but gee, he was powerful. He protected me from rockets. I was never killed by one.
Yeah.
It works. Blind faith and everything. And that was probably my biggest challenge, was coming to grips with that.
Yeah. Well, they were never fun.
I'll go along with that.
We got mortared 21 nights in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And man, we didn't appreciate that. And at any rate.
On one of your calendars, those photos of the radar sitting off to the side, we had those there to pick up the, on your calendar, we had those
for
picking up incoming mortars, and we had a counter mortar team of a couple of guns who were sitting there hot, ready to go. So, during the festive season, I was living in the bunker, and we could hear these things actually coming out of the tubes, just over there, and a couple of bodies came hurtling in and fell all over me, and these bloody mortars were falling, and said, "Where the hell's a bloody counter mortar team? Why don't they get out there and bloody silence them?" this voice at home, the count of more to 10, and you go and get stuffed. I'm not going out there. So, they used to be annoying. We used to disperse the aircraft all over the countryside so that we wouldn't lose all our aircraft. And so if Bearcat was being hit, the aircraft would go out back to Bearcat and everywhere. So the crew would just disappear and try and save a few of them in case they cleaned up the flight line.
Yeah.
In fact, that's another funny one. They were doing a run on an aircraft in maintenance. Had a pilot and a senior NCO, an Australian, in it, and a maintenance fellow, a TI. And mortars fell on the flight line, and they didn't bother shutting the aircraft down. And the Australian was a fairly rotund bloke, and he was running at a million miles an hour, tripped, rolled probably 20 metres back on his feet and disappeared into the darkness. Little funny things like that come back to the brain.
So did you go on R&R?
Yes, I came back home? Yep, came back home to Australia to see my six-month-old daughter.
Yeah.
Trouble is, as we came into Sydney, we got waved off because Sydney Airport was closed to fog. And so we went up to Brisbane, free flight, by the way, up to Brisbane and back with TWA, refueled and finally got in there. And so we'd lost a whole day of our R&R due to the adverse conditions, the weather. So that was great. The I had a full beard at that stage. A lot of us grew beards because we wore an Australian Army uniform. You didn't want to be mistaken for a soldier, so by growing a beard, that was one way of getting out of that sort of mistaken identity. But I was down in Vung Tau with the Australian Army, and this bloke approached me and congratulated me on arriving and doing this, that and the other, and disappeared. And the Army bloke I was with, I said, "What was that all about?" And he said, "I don't know." And anyway, it turns out that in the Australian Army, the Assault Pioneers platoon sergeant is permitted to wear a beard. The story goes that, he thought I was him because I was in Australian Army uniform and had a beard and I'd just come out of the sergeant's mess. And they grow a beard because when they're handling nitro, the headaches and what have you, they can wipe their fingers on their beard and it doesn't go into their skin. That's the theory behind it. I don't really believe it. But anyway, that was the story I was told.
Uh-huh. Did you have any discipline problems? Was the black and white an issue for you guys at that point in time? You mentioned drugs.
Not really. We didn't
this
really
is still really early in the game because it gets really bad near the end of the game.
Yes. I personally don't think we had a problem.
How many blacks did you have that you worked with?
One mainly, Bill Bell. He's a Spec 5, then he got made up to a 6. But I don't think he ever touched drugs. There was a young kid that came in after that. One of the young blokes, I'm told after the event that he used to use it a bit, one of the white guys, he was Jewish actually, because a cheeky young bugger came up and put his arms around me and another bloke took a photo and said, "Thanks a lot." And so what was that all about? And he said, "Oh, my father's a rabbi, he's got a beard like yours." You cheeky little bugger. But at times on the flight line you could smell it, smell marijuana. When we arrived at Black Horse, the narcs came around and they told us all about drugs. L&M cigarettes used to have a thing down the bottom, and there was always an indicator that there was drugs. And litter, marijuana cigarette, and passed around so we could have a smell of it. And one of the questions was, "Any of you blokes tried drugs?" And Teddy Richards said, "Bloody hell, you think I'd do that? You've seen the trouble I get into just drinking beer?" Which was true, of course, but...
That's a great line!
how Teddy survived, because Some of the Negroes used to walk around with the white power thing, and Ted, 9/10 pissed, used to go around, white power, white power, and used to have to try and cart him away before he got slaughtered. But because he is considered a stupid Australian, I think we'd probably get away with it. There was never any dramas that I was aware of in our lot. One bright and early morning, we did a raid on the troops' barracks to see if to catch drugs, and all the officers and senior NCOs went through, and a couple of pills were found, and that was about it. One of my guys, I searched, and he had a bloody revolver in there, and I got that and stuffed it in my pants, and I was walking away, and I thought, if he's that stupid, the bloody thing's probably loaded. And I just stuffed a bloody loaded revolver in my pants. But anyway, it wasn't, so I still got everything left there. We finished the drug raid. We went back to the admin area, and I used to smoke drum, rolly cigarettes, tobacco. And we're sort of conversations going on, and I noticed the conversation sort of stopped, and sort of looked up from rolling a cigarette to see everybody looking at me. I think they were under the impression that I'd found something and was going to give it a bit of a try. But and that was mistaken fairly well. Had some mama sons working on the line, and an old mama son eyes lit up when she saw me rolling a cigarette, and so I offered the makings, and she made this real thin cigarette, and she got there and lit it up. And she got as high as a kite on this drum. It's just ordinary tobacco that's all in the mind. She started flopping around like an untrained seal. So smoking that was different. You guys had Bull Durham, which was a dust-like powder that was absolutely disgusting. And also tried chewing tobacco, which I could not tolerate. It was way too harsh for me. So there was some of the cultural differences that that we had. But race-wise, I don't think there was any great problem. Good. Except I explained to Bill Bell one day how hard I'd be working by saying one of my standard sayings in Australia, been working like a bloody slave. And he went, whoof, and I thought, what's wrong with you? And then realised what I'd been saying, and he found that a bit offensive. But he accepted us fairly well. Because his name was Bell, naturally anybody called Bell is Dinger, so he was Dinger Bell. And one day I sort of walked in, and he's got a young Mexican kid, Garcia, but he barred up and he's got the finger shaking into his chest, and gee, that looks serious. He said, there's only two people in this place that can get away with calling me Dinger, and you're not one of them. That was probably about it. It seemed to be.
So, other than the mortars and rockets, the scariest time?
Oh, flying. That got a bit hairy at times. A hot LZ was hot LZ was a bit unnerving, but. It's the apprehension before you get there. When you're there, it seemed to, you'd got other things occupying your mind. One of the first times I did one, being totally untrained and using an M60 in an aircraft, I could use an M60 on the ground, I was trying to do that, but not airborne. And the belt got caught in the slipstream and sort of swung out and jammed. And I found that when the gun stops firing, everybody in the aircraft yells at you until you get it going again. And little things like that, you know, you learn to make sure it feeds in properly. And the other great thing was that being in a slick, I never flew in guns, but in slicks, the tube support that holds the M60, it's quite possible to hide behind that. And you feel quite secure. You can actually hide behind that bit of tubing. So, you know, it's all those sort of good things.
Uh, that's rich. Okay.
And the other thing that developed from that is that some very strong bonds of friendship between the two nations have there. We're probably closer now than we were then, because there used to be a few narks every now and again, but you know, niggles and what have you. But if we go to the States, you know, it's like a long lost brother, and you treat him very, very well. And to the extent where, you know, sort of in Oregon at CO, there's a memorial, and Ray Huberger and I have got our names on bricks that a mutual friend had purchased and put in a memorial wall, so we'll be together. So, you know, that type of bond and friendship is there. So that's one of the great positives that came out of it, was that that relationship with people from another country. So, yeah, it was good the way.
Wrapping up, what happened after Vietnam?
We came back in a flight from Saigon to Sydney. Went some leave, back into the fleet. Away you go, dispersed. I went back to 73 Squadron, but the guys that weren't aviation, they just disappeared back into the fleet to be that. We were despised by our contemporaries, because we'd spent 12 months away thoroughly enjoying ourselves, doing wonderful adventures and everything, and they were left at home to work and carry all this hard work that they used to do. And
with nobody and shooting at them.
Yeah, and we were up there enjoying ourselves, and that animosity is still alive today. It's there's people with chips on their shoulders about us. To the extent that one of the presidents of an association, state association, refers to us the helicopter boys. It's still there. But, we had this wonderful adventure, fun travel and adventure. In fact, that was the Army's recruiting slogan, FTA, in those days.
Now, the... did you guys receive any kind of combat pay from your government?
There was a little bit. There was a big pay discrepancy. Bob Kyle, a sub-lieutenant, aircraft commander, 1,000 hours, he was getting less than his Spec 4 fruit crew chief, but yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize that the Americans were paid...
very well.
Well, we didn't think it at the time, but... and now they're really paid, but... so I was really shocked to hear that there was not just a little pay differential, but quite noticeable.
Yep, and I think people are sort of the hierarchy is starting to realise. Like 2016, the Royal Australian Navy finally acknowledged that people like me, a non-aviator, was actually flew as a door gunner. And they produced 49 sets of wings. 9 of those went to Australian Army blokes, and 40 sailors got their gunner's wings. The REM finally acknowledged that we flew, that we didn't sit in air-conditioned comfort the whole time.
Well, and sometimes it was air-conditioned, but it was because the door was open on the Huey.
It was what doors. So that was 2016. 2017, the Australian government finally acknowledged that we were integrated into the 135th Assault Helicopter Company and allowed us to wear the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with palm leaf unit citation. This year, 2018, we're getting a unit citation of gallantry. So wings in 16, Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry 17, unit citation of gallantry 18. Look what's coming next year. 2019 should be a good year.
Fair amount of irony in your voice. Fair amount of irony. Okay, so how long did you stay in the Navy then after Vietnam?
Oh, about 5 years. I got out of the Navy and came back in end of 69, and I got out in middle of 73.
And so your time in Vietnam was not positive for your Navy career, or it was?
No, it wasn't for me, but because of the situation we're in, and I went back to 73 Squadron, I would never be promoted. You just can't pass the technical side of the Chiefs Board by working on B model Iroquois.
Uh-huh.
When you're competing against guys that have a long history working on things like Skyhawks and Trackers, where all the radar, for example, you don't have any exposure to radar, sonar, all those types of things. It's just very basic radios. You just don't go. So really there was no future in staying. Although my last 2 years I spent on radio control systems, that was a phenomenal job. It was really great, and I'd probably stay in the Navy forever if they'd left me there, but I was back into mainstream.
So when you got out of the Navy, what did you do?
I went to work for a company that actually built radio control surface targets, and but we never built any, so I wound up doing structural engineering, doing basic steelworks, built some fiberglass boats, cabin cruisers, 6-meter cabin cruisers, and then went to work for an electrical contractor, and then worked for a company as a maintenance guy for Queensland doing commercial laundry equipment, boilers, washing machines, dryers, folders, ironers, all those sort of things. Then I went down to Canberra and worked at Arroyo Valley. It was a space tracking station. I worked for the Smithsonian on their laser, satellite laser system. And and then, because that was nocturnal, I started teaching at a TAFE college during the day, and then finally got a job as a full-time TAFE teacher, electrical trades TAFE teacher, and then became a head of Department of Allied Trades, refrigeration, air conditioning, and all those sort of things. And then head of school was my last promotion. I worked on some national curriculum projects where we had a common core curriculum for refrigeration, air conditioning trades and post trades, getting all the syllabi from all over Australia, mincing it all up where we had a common one. So a guy who started his apprenticeship in Western Australia could go to Tasmania, continue his studies, then up to Darwin, continue his studies without all the rubbish that we used to go through with trying to get status and what have you. So that worked beautifully. It was fabulous. And as a reward for that, I was given the job as the ACT representative on the National Metals and Engineering Award restructuring, where we restructured the National Metals Awards. And that was a lot of hard work. And my reward from that was to be head of school, which was a different sort of a reward. And then I resigned and moved up to Mackay, worked as a refrigeration mechanic, maintenance coordinator at a hospital, facilities manager at a TAFE college, then went to an underground coal mine and worked as a communications and gas monitoring officer, and then after a heart attack retired from that, and became a part-time lettuce picker at a hydroponics farm, and then just retired totally. And do a lot of voluntary work. I was a volunteer welfare pension advocate for the Vietnam Veterans Association of Australia in Bundaberg, also the Returned Servicemen's League in Bundy. I'm into men's health. I'm the New South Wales ACT state rep on the men's health peer education. I was also in Queensland when I was up there. I was a North Queensland rep there. Secretary of the Men's Shed, General's Dog Bodies.
Yeah. Tell me about the Helicopter Flight Vietnam Association, if you'd have it. I don't think it has a real name, but...
No.
You're like the mother, father, sister, brother of it, and...
Yes, well, Mike Parrott summed that up. I think he introduced me to you as the de facto president of the non-existent RANHFV Association. I think that was the title he used.
Yeah.
We had our 50th reunion last year, and there was 196 of us, so I tried finding everybody, and there's my goal was, there was about 50 or 60 missing, and so I whittled it down to 10, which my aim was to get into single figures, so I didn't quite make it that far, but I try and keep the group together, and hence the little Vietnam Veterans Day things in Old Bar, where it tries to bring the people together, and we stay in contact with each other. I become the sort of point of contact for the members.
Mm-hmm.
There was 196 of us, 61 are dead, and 10 missing. So that's our basic stats.
So summing up, you're actually the Vietnam experience, but your Navy experience. I mean, if you had it all to do over again, would you do it? I mean, it's clearly formed your life.
I would have preferred to have done the Vietnam thing as a single man rather than as somebody who was married and their first child had just arrived. That wasn't particularly good. But it was certainly. There was a lot of benefits from it, but there's also a lot of negatives. One of the benefits being that I got fault-finding experience in 12 months that would take me a lifetime to accumulate outside of Vietnam. So,
for example,
there's a fault in that aircraft. Where is it? And in the wiring, you know, it's not just changing a box. It's applying a logical fault-finding process of, do you start here or do you start down there? So that gave me great inroads and what was it called, a diagnostic technician, where you have the ability to think in a fault-finding mode. So it's problem-solving. That really enhanced my fault-finding or problem-solving abilities. So it was really good from that point of view.
Yeah.
But the separation from wife and child is was one of the really negative sides of it.
Uh-huh.
My last few years in the Navy was a bit different. When I came back, I had difficulty settling in because of the amount of work you were doing, long, long days with a lot of it, to go back into my old job where, you know, that the people have been doing all this hard work while I was away enjoying myself, to go back and being a supervisory with a whole bunch of people, all I had to do was sign the end column on an aircraft and to release it from service. And I may only do that once or twice a day, and you sat there like a stunned mullet. So I used to go off flying and what have you, very boring. I couldn't settle in, so I used to try and find other little jobs to do and tasks and things to keep myself amused. The ability to sit still and drink coffee had gone.
Everybody was busy.
Yeah.
If you applied yourself, you know, if you were a bum, you were a bum, but... would you do it all over again, or I guess you just said there's
yes and no
better courses of action. Any thoughts that you would have, particularly that you'd like to pass on to your children or your grandchildren?
Oh, basically, be adaptable and make the best of any situation that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the...
Yeah?
Yeah, that's probably about it.
Uh-huh. Yep. You're finished?
Yep, that sounds good.
Okay. It's lovely, by the way.